My castaway this week is a singer. For more than 30 years, she's raised her voice in protest against injustice. Born into a Quaker family in New York, she made her mark at the age of 18, singing at the Newport Folk Festival. During the 60s, she achieved worldwide fame and for a while teamed up with another young folk singer called Bob Dylan. At the same time, she marched alongside Martin Luther King, withheld her taxes, and protested against the war in Vietnam. Today, she feels as strongly as ever about freedom and peace. Only this spring, she sang in Sarajevo to show support for the suffering people of Bosnia. She is Joan Baez. And I confess it's with great difficulty, Joan, that I say Baez and not Baez, because I must be one of millions who spent your whole career mispronouncing your name.
It's not in the priorities of things that concern me, since it's pronounced differently whichever country I'm in.
Which other countries pronounce it how?
Oh, in Germany it's Joan Betz, and in France it's Joan Baez, and in Spain it was originally Baez. Which is why it's confusing to people.
But it's a single syllable, Baez. We remember you too with long black hair and a very earnest, rather solemn face. And today you've got short, stylish hair and you're all smiles. Are you a completely different person?
I'm very different. And I think, you know, many people are stuck in some way in the 60s. And I, when they see me or hear me, they identify immediately with their time in the 60s. I don't think I had that good a time in the 60s. I mean, I was very, very serious about my work, and I was popping in and out of jail and doing demonstrations, and I was stimulated by it all, and I'm glad I did all of it. But I didn't have a great deal of fun. I didn't know what that meant yet, and that has come a little bit as the years have gone along.
So do you think of the person who did all that as quite another person for you?
I have tremendous admiration for the person who did all that.
Yeah.
I do think of it as another person, yeah.
And you admire, obviously, what she achieved. You sound as if you kind of wonder how she did it.
I do. It seemed like an enormous load that she was carrying around with some sort of feeling that it was destiny.
But you got a lot out of it. It sounds as
I
if
did.
you had a lot of joy, maybe, at your achievement at the time, but not a lot of fun in the sense that the rest of us were having fun in the 60s.
Yes, and I even thought that fun was somehow a bad word, that joy was okay because it was profound, but that fun was definitely a no-no. And a lot of this is coming down from, Catholic background on my father's side into Quakerism and then down to me, and my mother's side, Episcopalian minister, and then to Quakerism and down to me. And there was a lot of rigid behavioral stuff in the house when we were little. And so, you know, I didn't know about lightening up. I really didn't.
So how would this Joan Baez, today's Joan, like the idea of being cast away on a desert island alone?
Oh, I wouldn't be nuts about it. I've spent a lot of time in my life alone. I'm good at it, but I was rather looking forward to spending less time alone, so maybe it's not the right time in my life to be cast away.
What's the first record you'll play when you get there?
It seems as though the first record that comes to my mind whenever the Desert Island Discs are ever discussed is U.C. Buehrling, Salut de Mur, Chaste et Pure. I was brought up hearing his voice in our house. My mother used to stop her cleaning or vacuuming or whatever she was doing, and she wasn't aware of this, and she would stand, and she'd look up, and she'd go, at a certain point, she'd go, oh, that's so beautiful. And so I can't hear this song without without hearing my mother's voice.
Presence d'une âme innocente.
Jussi Björling singing the aria Salut demeure chaste et pure from Act 3 of Gounod's Faust with the Stockholm Royal Orchestra conducted by Nils Gravelius. Your mother was Scottish, I think, Joan.
She's born in Edinburgh.
Hmm? Mm. And you got, though, your dark eyes and your dark hair from your father.
My mother's dark as well.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. But he was Mexican?
He's Mexican-Spanish, yes.
And what did your father do?
My father taught physics in different universities, and then we spent a year in the Middle East when he went with UNESCO to build a physics laboratory and teach physics.
Mm. And you had two sisters. You were the middle one.
Mm-hmm.
Was there ever any jealousy between you?
Yes. Yeah. And very, very different. The older one especially is very different from me. I'm only becoming friends with her now, which is a wonderful thing to have happen.
Did you fall out with her because of your fame and success?
No. Mm-mm. No, we just always hated each other. I mean, you know, I don't think that we were taught to love each other very well. And I think that the sibling rivalry just kind of took over.
But there was no jealousy of you or your fame?
Oh, I think so. Of my fame? Probably. I think everybody in my family, including my parents, had different reactions to my fame. Mm-hmm. I think my father was jealous at the beginning, probably more than anybody else.
And yet he helped promote you in the first place, didn't he?
Not really. In the first place, he just took us into Harvard Square unwittingly, saying, "Well, come on, girls." And he wanted to show us all these little coffee shops. And so the girls piled in the car. That's when we still said girls. His wife and three daughters. And we went off to see Tulla's Coffee Grinder coffee shop in Harvard Square. And I found my heart in the folk music, in the Harvard students with their lovely curly locks and their guitars and their the music, the ballads, their beauty of the words.
And did you feel in that moment then when you came into that crowd, did you feel you'd arrived, you were home, it was for you?
In some way I was, although I always felt a bit odd, you know, wherever I was.
Had you felt odd at school?
I'd felt odd as far back as I can remember, yeah.
In what way at school?
Well, you know, as it turns out, I think I was probably quite dyslexic. You know, people didn't know how to diagnose that in those days, or didn't even come up for discussion. We just kind of scrambled to find out how to navigate our way through the things we couldn't understand or couldn't read or couldn't absorb. And so I drew. And I would draw, and I would draw beautifully. I drew the history of the American Negro in those days when we said Negro, the history of the hair root. I mean, I drew whatever would get me by in these classes.
Were you, even at school, a protester? Did you know your own mind?
I had much more clarity about my feelings about nonviolence and social political change than I did about music and about most other things in my life. And by the time I was 15, I had stopped saluting the flag, any flag, which, of course, nobody understood because they figured as soon as I didn't salute the American flag, I must be a pinko commie. And then we had an air raid drill in our high school, so I guess I was in 11th grade. And I went home to my father's physics books and found out how long it took for a missile to get from Moscow to Palo Alto High School and realized it was a hoax. I mean, I suspected it was a hoax, but then I had proof in hand. So when the bell rang and everybody went dashing home to have their, what they were calling their bomb parties in their swimming pools, I stayed in school to protest. And that was really the beginning of a very visible career of nonviolent action.
Your first act of civil disobedience.
Yes, it was, yeah.
Let's have record number two.
Okay, the Goldberg Variations by Glenn Gould. I was introduced to that when I must have been 16 or 17 again by my mother. Any classical music was really my mother's doing. And I just entered some kind of trance when he played, and I was fascinated by his humming, humming all through it, that somebody who was, that he must have been in another state to not even care or notice that he was humming along with this magnificent playing. Thank you.
Glenn Gould playing one of Bach's Goldberg variations. I read that you helped to overcome shyness in adolescence, really, by singing, by playing. It was a way you could communicate with boys when you couldn't actually speak to them.
It was a way I could communicate with everybody. When you say that, I know I was a terrific little flirt, but at the same time, what came to my mind was that girls' clique in junior high school that I wanted so badly to be a part of. And so it was pretty much to those girls that I started with my little ukulele at noontime, entertaining them. And I would do imitations of Elvis Presley and whoever else was, you know, currently being heard on the radio. And I was accepted in a certain way, which was better than not being accepted at all. Mm. It was kind of a little bit of a court jester, but it was better than nothing.
And you taught yourself how to warble your voice.
I had admired the human voice and the violin more than anything else since I think I started listening when I was 6 or 7. And by 8 years old, those were the two things that I loved the most in music. And so I wanted a vibrato in my little voice, which was straight as a pin. It was true. It had very good pitch and some nice kind of tone to it. But the only way I could get it to bump up and down and make a vibrato was if I manipulated my Adam's apple with my finger from the outside, standing in front of the mirror. And then I liked that sound. So I would get in the shower and I would do that. And then I would try without manipulating it. And little by little, in fact, it was quite quick, the vibrato started to develop on its own. Yeah,
without you having to touch your Adam's apple.
Exactly. And then pretty soon after that, I couldn't sing without the vibrato.
And your parents encouraged you in all of this?
My mother absolutely did. And my mother has been one of those people who has appreciated my gift in the way that makes me the happiest. She feels it's a gift from God, and she's grateful for the way I've used it.
Do you think of your voice as a gift?
I do. Absolutely. I don't think it has the slightest thing to do with me. All I try to do is maintenance and offer it in the most useful and soulful ways that I can.
Mm. It certainly is that. I mean, the phrase that one reads that crops up again and again about your voice is that it's achingly pure. Is that a phrase you like?
Oh, yeah. That's very nice.
Let's talk about your first public appearance, that professional debut at the Newport Folk Festival, Rhode Island, in front of some 13,000 people.
You must have been... biggest crowd I'd ever seen.
Terrified.
I was absolutely terrified. I can just say that I can feel the leather thongs on my Jesus sandals and my knees shaking just above that. And, you know, I would think when I'd get like that, because I had terrible stage fright for years, and I think if I were walking to the guillotine, it wouldn't feel any different. I already know what it feels like to walk to the guillotine.
Hmm. How long did that go on into your career?
It went fairly strongly for a number of years, and then little by little, I mean, I just tackled it every way that I could. And I would say in the last 2 years that it's gone. I mean, it's...
Just the last 2 years?
Mm-hmm.
No wonder during all those early years you say you didn't have much fun.
I didn't have much fun. I was too tired. I was too tired doing all those neurotic reactions and then singing these beautiful shows.
Let's have record number 3.
What do we have here? I put my glasses on. Kathleen Ferrier, again, my mother. I would sit with my head in loudspeakers starting from, I don't know, whenever her material started to be around, then I would sing along with it. I mean, I can hum along or sing along with anything she's ever sung, and I have no idea what she's singing about or half the time what the languages are.
Kathleen Ferrier singing O Thou That Tellest Good Tidings to Zion from Handel's Messiah with the London Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Sir Adrian Bolt. So the 60s dawned, Joan Baez. You recorded your first albums, you toured the southern campuses singing We Shall Overcome and Oh Freedom, and you found yourself on the front of Time magazine, and you were a star. Why do you think it happened for you? What do you think was right about you and the time that brought it all together?
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is that I underestimated the gift for many years. The gift is really enormous. There's nothing egotistical about saying that, because it is a gift. So that is part of it.
But you're also, if you like, with your voice, the right person in the right decade.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And the proof of that, I believe, is that directly at the end of the war in Vietnam, my record sales took a huge plunge, because I had never known anything else, because the civil rights had immediately after the ballads, I had started singing ballads and was known for that, and within 2 or 3 years, it was Bob Dylan, contemporary music, and then traveling around in the South and singing with Dr. King. And so for me, the hats of social political work and music had always been very simple.
You obviously had great power, therefore, in political circles. I mean, I know the FBI regarded you as a dangerous subversive.
Oh, very flattering.
But it was a huge story when in 64 you refused to pay your taxes because you said part of them were going towards armaments. Do you feel that the same thing would have happened for you without that kind of focus, without the Vietnam focus?
No. No, I think that we reflect the times, the music reflects the times reflect the music. I mean, it all bounces back and forth, and these radical changes happen when places are politically charged. The United States was as politically charged as I have ever known it. In the early 60s with civil rights movement and then the war in Vietnam.
But did you feel a responsibility for the power that you had?
I did, yes. And I still do. I do.
How well did you know Martin Luther King?
I knew him some. I mean, I was in on some of the fun times and some of the fun meetings and the behind-the-scenes get-togethers that I hoped to be in on. You know, he was terribly funny. And they laughed and joked, but like other people with that kind of position, he was, I think, afraid to do that in public. So you don't see pictures of him or see footage of him just smiling. You do of Gandhi. I don't think Gandhi was afraid of anything.
But, of course, you were not just another protester or just not somebody who was simply standing up with a very strong message. You were more than that. You were a very famous one, and you were a very rich one, which made you unusual because you were often fighting on the side of people who suffered poverty and deprivation. Were you compromised by the fact that you had so much money by then?
I didn't have so much money. I just kept giving it all away. And that was, you know, I didn't think I was supposed to have money. And so, I mean, I can remember sitting in a house when I was about 25 years old, just writing out checks. I mean, anybody who wrote and asked for money, I'd send them something. Yeah. Anywhere from a $5 check to $2,000.
So how many people have you bought cars for example?
Oh, lots. That was a phase I went through, and I just bought cars for people. I mean, it just made me deliriously happy to come tootling up in a new whatever it was and turn the keys over to somebody.
Again, an enormous power over people, in a sense.
Well, that's true, too. And I didn't think of the downside of that and what that does to a relationship and to friends, and how did I view friends and did I have friends and so on. So a few have survived. A few very, very, very good friends have survived all that bizarreness because they had a clear enough picture of what a friendship was supposed to be.
Record number 4.
Where are we? Scottish Fantasy by Yasha Heifetz. Again, my mom. I mean, it's something that it really is because of Heifetz. It's and because I heard this particular piece over and over again. But Heifetz to me is the ultimate violinist.
Thank you. part of the Allegro from Bruch's Scottish Fantasy, played by Yasha Heifetz with the new Symphony Orchestra of London, conducted by Sir Malcolm Sargent. You met Bob Dylan in 1961. You were both 20, but you were a much bigger star than him at the time. What were your first impressions of him?
People had told me about this incredible guy writing these incredible songs, and he was just scruffier than I had pictured. He was very scruffy, but what they said about the songwriting to me was true. I guess I saw him for the first time in Gertie's Folk City, which is where one went in New York to hear local folk music. And he sang Blowing in the Wind that night. You know, so history makes itself.
Were you aware then that he had an extraordinary talent?
Yes, I was.
But you really started his career for him, didn't you? You launched him in many ways.
Well, you know, I mean, I take that with a grain of salt. I adored his music, and I adored him, and this was jolly fun racing around the country, which is what I was doing, driving to my own shows, and I would present him during my concert. And so, you know, a certain credit is offered to me for that, but it would have been just a question of time.
But he's, yes, but he said, since then, I think in his autobiography, he said, she brought me up. It sounds as if he regarded you as a bit of a mother figure.
I was very mother with him, yeah.
Were you? Mm-hmm. And together, you know, the times they're changing was almost your signature tune, really. Mm-hmm. Were you in love, would you say?
I don't know that I'm capable of that, but it was certainly a happy match for a while. Mm. He was very creative during the short time that we were together, and I was going around stealing his songs. I mean, literally, a four-letter word he wrote dropped behind a piano somewhere and forgot about, and I retrieved it in my own house and learned it. And I guess a year later was singing it, and he said, hey, that's a great song. Where's that from? You wrote it, you dope, you know?
Yeah. So how would you characterize those years with him? I mean, great fun. I mean, to be two people who enjoyed each other's company, were kind of addicted to each other in some kind of way, presumably.
Oh, sure. I mean, yeah, I wouldn't deny any of that.
Were there any
and more so than anybody else I was ever sort of coupled up with in one way or another, in any way. And that was a magical time.
Yeah. Were there any professional jealousies between you in the end? Did you?
Well, I'm sure it was all, you know, it all went completely to hell. We didn't have to go into all that. But I just remember, as you asked that, there's this poster the first time we gave a concert together, and hours were spent on how to devise this poster so that one name was not higher than another and didn't come first, and so one picture of us is higher than the other, and then that person's name is lower than the other, and so on and so on. I mean, it just was this network of nonsense of how we were going to present ourselves equally.
Next piece of music. This is you singing.
This is me, yeah. I originally had written down my first album, but that was a totally different voice to me. That was a child's voice. So I ended up choosing Diamonds and Rust as a classic, and I think I would want to hear my own voice if I was stuck on the island for 25 years and lost my voice. I'd want to hear what it was like once.
Where are you calling from? A booth in the Midwest.
'Diamonds and Rust,' sung by my castaway Joan Baez. Was that written about Bob Dylan, that song?
For years, I wouldn't say who it was written about, and then there was this funny moment when I went on the Rolling Thunder tour with Bob, and this and 'Diamonds and Rust' had come out fairly recently, and he said, we're all such egomaniacs. He said, you can do that new one, you can do that new one, that diamonds thing. I said, oh, you mean the one I wrote about my husband? And it just stopped him just dead in his tracks. And I burst out laughing. I said, only teasing, Bob. I couldn't resist.
So it was all about him. But what you did when you were at the height of your fame was that you were not only singing the songs and writing the protests, you were actually out there protesting as well, which is something, yes, that Dylan didn't do, wasn't it?
something that most singers really didn't do that much of. I mean, Gandhi said, there will always be conflict in the world. The question is whether we're going to confront it. If it isn't in front of your face, go find it, because it's there, and then deal with it when you get there. And for some reason, that was natural to me to do.
So when you go to Sarajevo, as you did this spring, what are you doing for them? I mean, in the past, you were enormously famous. You would have brought enormous publicity and the spotlight on where you went. You don't necessarily make that happen today. So are you just going to sing to people who are having a rough time? Or what are you doing?
Well, I think that I am prepared for the fact that sometimes I do those things and nobody especially hears about them. I mean, that's the way it is. And I was prepared for that. I went to Sarajevo because somebody said, the people in Sarajevo have asked you to come and try and lift their spirits after a year of siege. And so there wasn't any question to me at that point that it was the appropriate kind of thing that I do and do well. And so, of course, I went and they lifted my spirits. I mean, it's just a joke. It's their courage. You know, it's their astounding behavior in this disgusting situation that, you know, fed my spiritual and moral everything, all of my needs.
Next piece of music.
What do we have here? Van Morrison, Astral Weeks. I listened to Astral Weeks every single night for I don't know how many months just before I had my son. And Madame George was the one I think I was addicted to. And this occurs to me that this is a song that my son knows by heart somewhere in his system, whether he's ever listened to it in his conscious life or not.
It ain't sad, the making of the stops. A kid's out in the street collecting bottle tops. Gone for cigarettes and matches in the shops. Happy taking Madame Joy.
Van Morrison and Madame George, that's from your darker side, you say?
Oh, I think so, because this song is absolutely bizarre. And he's such a far cry from Buerling, it's not even a joke.
You're 52 now, Joan.
Yes.
What about on the personal front? You seemed to say earlier on that you didn't think you were capable of love.
Yeah, I did say that. And I think I would say that after this pretty extensive amount of work I've done in the last few years to unearth some of the things that were making my phobias work, you know, and keeping the anxiety attacks at a high level and so on, that I think that it would be nice to be able to share my life. That's something I really never thought I'd hear myself say.
What about the voice? How do you look after it? You've said on a couple of occasions that vocal cords can't last forever. How long do they last?
Oh, I would think I have somewhere between 6 and 12 years of the voice being as good as it is now, and it's good now.
So what do you do to look after it?
I just have to be very, very careful. And all those things that I never knew about or cared about or thought had anything to do with me, I do them all now because I'm 52. When I was 25, I didn't have to.
And no drugs?
No drugs.
You banned those for a long time.
Well, I never did drugs in the way that everybody assumes that I did. It didn't work for me. I was too scared. None of it. No cocaine, no amphetamines. I never did an acid trip. And that's news to some people. I remember some guy coming up to my house when I lived in Carmel, and he had the Farewell Angelina record, which has this sort of daffy picture of me on the cover. It's an Avedon. And I used to go into sort of trances when I would do those photo sessions, and I looked stoned. And he said, "Wow, man, this is really cool. You must have really been out there." I didn't even know what he was talking about. You know, for years, people left little pills on the stool up where I was singing on the stage, and I chucked the things out. I didn't relate to it.
Record number 7.
I figured I wouldn't be able to survive on a desert island without some dance music. And the dance music I really respond to and, should we say, resonate with the most is Latin. And the Gypsy Kings are my favorite.
They are! ¿Cómo podías tú vivir?
the Gypsy Kings and Sinéa. So, prepare to be cast away now. How do you visualise yourself on this desert island? How will you spend your time?
Oh, it depends if I get a horse or not, I guess. I will see myself as having a horse to ride. How do I spend my time?
And we don't allow you a horse, you see.
Well, I think probably my Quaker heritage would come in very, very handy, meaning looking for whatever is within ourselves to depend upon, since obviously it's going to be a bit tacky what we have outside to depend upon. So I would probably have to get a little more serious about meditation.
But would you miss making music? Would you miss the adoration of the audience?
Oh, I suppose in a way, if I were put on an island, I wouldn't have to worry about it. I mean, I've had enough. I've had a lot. Although we say that, you know, and I say, well, when I quit singing, and I'll probably do 5 years of farewell concerts the way everybody else does. You say, this is it. And then you do it again. And
well, because people keep asking you.
Sure, yeah.
Difficult to say no.
Sure. When out on a desert island, I wouldn't have to say no.
And you could manage well without it.
That's probably. Probably. I mean, it's been close to 35 years I will have been singing for people.
Last record.
Jackson Browne, Late for the Sky. To me, a very beautiful album, and one that's pretty well lodged in my heart.
Tracing our steps from the beginning until they vanished into the air. Trying to understand how our lives had led us there.
Jackson Browne and Late for the Sky. So if you could only take one of those records, Joan, which one would it
be? Bewling.
Bewling.
Yeah.
What about your book? You've got the Bible waiting for you on the beach, and you've got the complete works of Shakespeare. That should keep you going for a while. But what single book of your own would you like on top of that pile?
Well, I mentioned earlier that you found out rather late in life, that I had a sort of dyslexic interference with reading, but I could read things that had a storyline, and I somehow could read anything that really moved my heart. As soon as that happened, bang, I was in the book and I was fine. Diary of Anne Frank.
And what about your luxury? It can't be a horse, it can't be anything animate.
Well, you know, if you said luxury and I sort of thought about it wrong, I thought of, you know, what would I take as just my a little reminder. And so there were just little things. There's a little amethyst stone from Mexico that reminds me about one part of my life. There was an Apache tear stone that my son gave me, and I carry him in this little pouch. And in fact, I would just take this pouch as it is.
And you wear it around your neck.
And this wasn't on the list I gave you, but it has a silver lion in it. And the lion will protect me on the beach of the island.
So your very own personal pouch of luxury.
I think that's, yeah.
Joan Baez, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you for having me.